the members of the panel. They will then each present for 10 minutes, and only 10 minutes, and we will then hopefully have some time for questions and discussion. So this panel is the gender update, looking at issues pertaining to gender in the region. Our first speaker is Peter Farrow. Peter is Director General of the Secretariat for the Melanesian Spearhead Group, and he was previously Deputy Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat. Peter joins us today with our thanks at what is an extremely busy time for him and his team, and he's going to be discussing the issue of women's disempowerment in Melanesia. He'll be followed by Susan Ferguson. Susan is the lead specialist on gender for the Pacific Division in AusAid, and in that capacity she's been involved in the design of the Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development Programme, and that will be the subject of her presentation today. Susan comes from a community development background and has worked for many years overseas on governance and gender programs. She's spent nearly 5 years in Papua New Guinea and 1 year in Solomon Islands. Andrea Ifland is ADB's Regional Director of the Pacific Liaison and Coordination Office in Sydney. She has a great depth of experience in relation to economics in the Pacific, including her own postgraduate research and work that she's done, particularly in relation to private sector development with UNDP and subsequently with the bank as a senior economist. Andrea today will be talking on experiences that the bank has derived from the private sector development initiative, particularly in relation to the economic empowerment of women. And our final speaker this afternoon will be Amanda Jupp. Amanda works with Coffee International Development as project manager for the AusAid-funded Enterprise Challenge Fund. And in a previous life, she spent a year with VanWards, which is a microfinance organization in Vanuatu, as an Australian Youth Ambassador for Development. Amanda's going to be talking today on the Pacific experience of the ECF, and again, she's going to be particularly focusing on economic empowerment of women. So ladies and gentlemen, if you could thank in advance your panel, and then we'll proceed to Peter's presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Tess, and I was just trying to introduce myself to all good ladies because I think we should change the subject. It's actually should be male this. But anyway, I was asked to try and speak to us about this particular topic, which is women disempowerment in Melanesia. I would think that it's another way of looking at the normal issue of women empowerment, which our good ladies will be talking to us about. And as I was thinking about what to say, I found it a bit difficult to actually understand what I should be sharing with us this afternoon. But then it occurred to me that women disempowerment is not necessarily the antonym of women empowerment. There are a number of issues in both sides of this particular issue, which makes them a bit different. And so I tried to perhaps look at it from the perspective of women disempowerment in Melanesia, and especially from the perspective of from the perspective of the involvement of I'm sorry, somehow this particular presentation is all over the place. I'm not sure how it was loaded up, but it doesn't seem to follow the sequence of the issues that I was going to speak to you about. Anyway, the plan is for me to try and share with you some facts about women disempowerment in Melanesia, and then look at which areas, which sectors in Melanesia involves women underrepresentation, and then try to look at some causes of women disempowerment, and then finally to share some ideas about how we might change that, we might make a difference in reversing that particular matter. And I thought we might start by looking at this particular table in terms of comparing the total population in Melanesian countries and look at how women are faring in terms of that population. You would know that it's almost an equal proportion of the population are women in all of Melanesia. For example, in Fiji, you almost have about 50% there. And also in Papua New Guinea, total population of about 7 million, and you have 3.4 million of those are women. And the same in the Solomon Islands. Also in Vanuatu, you would note that of a total population of 260,000 people, about 90,000 are women. And then you can look at the economically active representation of that proportion of the population in terms of our women. 26 in Fiji, 66% in Papua New Guinea. 85% in the Solomons and 80% in the Republic of Vanuatu. In terms of politically active, very strong in Fiji before and also now in terms of their advocacy of political issues as well as the women's rights, but very weak in the rest of Melanesia, particularly in Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and the Republic of Vanuatu. In terms of the actual employment numbers, you would note that the independent state of Papua New Guinea has a very low employment rate for women. I think that's a structural issue rather than a design issue in terms of the numbers of women that are interested to engage in formal employment. In terms of the political representation, again, a very sad story there. In Papua New Guinea, we only have one woman represented in the national legislature. In Solomon Islands, luckily we had also one woman there. And in the Republic of Vanuatu, one lady, but she's in the provincial setup rather than in the national government. So I think this tells us a story about how our women are faring in terms of empowerment and also in terms of how we are engaging them in productive activities. And these are some of the areas where that underrepresentation is quite prominent. Politics, as I've shown, formal employment in business, education, and also national and community decision making. By comparison, our women are doing very well in sports. They are also doing very well in church work, in advocacy, as well as NSA activities. Causes of disempowerment, I have to be very careful here, but as a new area of discourse, of research, probably these are some of the issues that we might discuss. I did have some informal discussions with some of our good ladies attending this particular conference, and these are some of the ideas that they think are potential causes for women disempowerment. They think the cultural issues are not actually causes of disempowerment per se, but it's the manipulation of culture that is causing a problem for our women. Also, in terms of domestic violence, that's a major issue for our women. It actually demoralizes them in terms of their courage and confidence. And then you can look at the issues of special treatment. It's arguable, but there is a view that the more you provide special treatment for our women, the more there is an acceptance of the fact that they might be different from us, which validly might be true, but I think there was a traditional view that men and women are equal. And then, of course, the activities of our women interest group, they are doing an excellent job in terms of providing promoting women rights and women issues, but unfortunately there might be a slight difference in the way they are doing. The representation is not actually protecting women rights. They actually intended to use women groups for different agendas, and so the issue of women empowerment gets lost in that particular advocacy. The issue of limitations of indicators in terms of capturing the activities that our women are involved in seems to be a problem. They are not inclusive, which is why there are some agencies who are looking at bringing around different indicators to try and capture all the activities of our women as well. Issues around legal language use in documents. I think some of the descriptions, some of the nomenclatures used by our legal minds in terms of the contracts can sometimes lead to a discouragement for our women, basically because maybe the language is not the right one to use in particular context. And then, of course, we know this issue about economic opportunities for our women. There does not seem to be many around, and therefore their ability to be involved in formal activities is not really as high as we would expect it. Now, how can we make a difference? I would suggest that we should perhaps go back to how it was before, where we treated our women as equal as men. I must acknowledge that there is a biological difference with our makeup, but I think in terms of status, women are equal as men. Also, can make a start, can make a difference by suggesting that the language we use, the nomenclatures we use in our legal documents, as well as some of the discussion papers, would need to find inclusive terminologies and references that would actually encourage our women to make an impact in economic development. And finally, I think we need to allow our women more freedom to decide for themselves. Often not in our rural communities, there are set cultural values about how women participate in decision making. But as I said earlier on, somehow in the process of deciding, for example, resource allocation, women are normally excluded from decision making about land use, about decisions about how people relate to each other in terms of the communities and village setting. I think if we did all this, we might find ourselves becoming more appreciative of how we might be able to integrate our women, both in decision-making, as well as to allowing them to participate in the political decisions that happen in our respective countries and setting. I'm being reminded by our chair that I'm done, and I believe I'm done. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd just like to say thank you very much to the organisers for inviting me here today. I'm going to be talking to you about the Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development Program, which is one of AusAid's new programs, and I'm really delighted to do so because it's quite, quite a cutting-edge kind of a program. So I'm looking forward to your responses to my my presentation as well. So. This is a 10-year program, which is unusual for AusAid in itself, in recognition that a lot of the barriers that women face in achieving equality are long-term, you know, long-term changes are needed and long-term support over really generations, actually. But 10 years is a good start. So it involves $320 million spent over 14 countries over those 10 years. And the initiative was launched at Pacific Island Forum in 2012. To the acclaim of the prime ministers of the 14 Pacific countries. In fact, several of them, Papua New Guinea and Samoan, Prime Minister launched it alongside the Australian government. So at the same time, they launched a gender declaration, which committed all the 14 nations to a range of different areas of improvements. And they are around things around leadership, as you talked about. And in fact, they did commit to temporary special measures for women in parliaments and also at local level, and also looking at women on boards, for example. So women's leadership, there were a whole range of agreements there. There's also agreements around women's economic participation and looking at informal areas of employment, so in produce markets and those kinds of things, improving the safety and the voice of women to local government to improve those markets. So there's quite a range of things that Pacific Island leaders have agreed to, which is great because this program very much aligns with a lot of those agreements. So really, before moving on, I just wanted to talk a little bit about why AusAid decided to fund this initiative. In the past, a lot of the work that we've done in AusAid has very much followed a mainstreaming approach. You know, whatever investments we make are meant to include women and benefits for women. And really, the World Development Report that the World Bank launched in 2012 around gender equality was very kind of, transformational, actually, for AusAid's work in recognising that in many respects, mainstreaming works if there aren't particular and persistent barriers that are illogical, for example, or are particularly discriminatory. So getting more schools into more communities is going to immediately impact on women or girls and boys' education, except in areas where there's discrimination against girls that stop them going to schools. So there's an argument you could put in more roads, you could build more schools and hospitals, but if women's mobility is hindered by, for instance, the threat of violence, they're not going to use those schools. So particular investments need to be made around the areas of discrimination and disadvantage. So this program, so that's really what this program is, to add additional focus around those key areas of disadvantage that women in the Pacific experience. So we recognise that in 10 years, really, probably the most we'll be able to do is help Pacific Island advocates, whether they're government or community-based, to shift some things within targeted areas. The whole, you know, everything's not going to change in every country over that 10 years. So we're looking at how do we target and focus locality as well as on particular areas of disadvantage. This is a very long, boring-looking slide, but these are the seven key result areas. The first three are what we call underlying investments, really. These are things that we will be investing in. So, for instance, enhanced knowledge and evidence base to inform policy, all of ours, Pacific countries and Australia's policy, to improve our practice in meeting the needs of disadvantaged women. We also want to strengthen women's groups and coalitions for change, as well as male advocates, because we recognise that it's critical for men to be involved in these changes. These are changes between the relationships between women and men. Both have to change. So, in you know, around the world, these changes are not usually led automatically by government. I mean, we can look at the Australian government as an example of that. The changes that have occurred have been largely driven by women advocates and their supporters from community level, demanding changes. So we want to support voices of Pacific Island women and men to ask for those changes. The third one, you know, you mentioned in your talk about their social norms and culture. It's very tricky for a donor to skate out onto the thin ice of cultural change. But actually, we had to put this in here because the first reason is that everyone we talked to, men and women in the Pacific, and we had extensive consultations that have continued over the year, have said this has to be in there because a lot of the things that lock women into disadvantage are within family relationships. Some of those things are, you know, because of the colonial past, their missionary past, for example. But wherever they've come from, they exist now, and women and some men want to see some changes there. So the areas that we're calling direct investments are around improved women's leadership and decision-making, and we're particularly interested to look at that at community level as a starting point, because a lot of the investments AusAid's made is around helping, you know, fund, for instance, CDI, which is based here at the ANU, do candidate training for women candidates. But we recognise actually a lot of the barriers women candidates face are not their own. You know, they may be very capable, but they can't, you know, the voters aren't going to vote for them because they don't see women as leaders, for example. So we're interested in looking at that change at community level in dialogue between men and women, girls and boys. Increased economic opportunities, and you spoke about that. Women have half the number of formal jobs in the Pacific generally than men. What can we do in the formal sector and also the informal sector to improve the incomes and reduce poverty? We want to support reduced violence against women and more services for women, because we know that this is a key barrier for women's empowerment in the Pacific. And that is one of the areas where there is actually extensive valid data around the numbers of women who experience violence. And we also want to look at our large investments, because $320 million over 10 years is not so much when you compare it to what we invest in health and education in the Pacific. So we want to look at those investments too and see how we can scale up the impact for women's empowerment. So just a couple of basic things about the program. There will be some kind of hub in Fiji that will coordinate the regional aspects of this program. There'll also be an outpost in PNG. It's the largest country. There are arguably a lot of the key issues that women face can be found there. And so we want to make sure that there's support and resourcing for PNG to really use this program. And what's interesting as well for me, having been a gender advisor in AusAid for 6 years or so now, is the fact that 70% of the program is incurring through country programs, so they are beginning to take much more ownership of the program. And if you, those who aren't AusAiders, there's always this kind of rub between regional programs and country-based programs. That ownership is really important, so I think that's been a really good thing. There's three country plans. So at the moment, there's a regional design occurring, and that will finish middle of August. At the same time, there's country planning processes that have been very participatory, and some of you have been to those processes in your countries. And PNG, Solomon Islands and Cook Islands are finished. The plans are online if you want to have a look. There's draft plans for the next four, and Samoa is the last one, and that's being completed at the moment. There's been a range of partnerships established with government, NGOs and development partners, which was great. And just a little snapshot. How am I going time-wise? Okay. We're investing in the UN Safe Cities Program in PNG in recognition of the fact that the majority of women's income-earning opportunities are in the informal sector, often in very unsafe environments. Some of the markets in Port Moresby, of course, you would know. There are a number of issues that women and men face in those markets. So there's been a range of support that UN Women's doing around improving the women vendors' voice to local government, trying to get the local government to invest back into the markets to improve the safety and the environment so they can sell more easily. And also, again, those of you who are from Port Moresby will have probably seen some of the work in Gerahu Market, new drainage systems and water, safe toilets, so women can sell their stuff in safety. So you've probably been reading while I've been talking. I'm going to skim along. These are just a couple of the things that are occurring. We're very keen to work with the churches in the Pacific in recognition of the fact that so many churches have such a key influence on people's lives, and there's a lot of interest in the churches and diversity to take up this looking at messaging around violence against women and what the church says about that, that it's not actually biblical, etc. So I'm out of time. So I'll finish. Thank you. afternoon, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to share with you some of the results we have been able to achieve over the last 6 years with the Private Sector Development Initiative, which is a co-finance initiative with AusAid, and recently we also got NZAID involved, so for the next 6 years to come. Now, going on its own, this is a bit of a problem. So I can't refer to it. Let me see if I can go. No, this is going forward.
Andrew, you were saying how much you like impromptu talks.
Yes, okay, great. Now, let's leave this aside, and I keep talking whilst maybe you give me a hand on this. I didn't realize that it was animated. This was not the intention. So, the private sector... Okay, fine. I scroll down with this. Fine. Great. The Private Sector Development Initiative, as I said, is a cooperation between three partners. It's ADB, it's AusAid, and NZAID program. It has been in operations for the last 6 years. It's in its third phase, and the third phase is going to have another 6 years to come. Now, on this specifically, we had focused for the last two phases on only three areas, and these are also the areas which I would like to show some results we have achieved in the context of economic empowerment of women, which is not an explicit objective of the program, which is important to note. It's not explicit. But sometimes it's better not to have explicit objectives, but your approaching is what I heard before, like saying everybody's equal, and then we have a look at what the results are like, and at the end of the day, we see that women are, by default, empowered more than men are. So, having said that and put that up front, I'm not so much a friend of positive discrimination. I've never been, but I've learned that sometimes it's necessary to do so to achieve results. Having said that, we have attempted, in the context of the Private Sector Development Initiative, to put together a flowchart to show a cause-effect relationship. This is only a snapshot, and it basically looks at legal structures, what Peter had mentioned, and we go into some details on that. It looks at access to finance, which is absolutely critical, and that in turn has quite a bearing on the ownership of land and prevents women from having access to finance, which is critical, and we have some solutions there as well. And also the heavy burden on women and the demand on time on women, which basically disadvantages them in the context of becoming economically active in the sense of increasing their economic power and earning capacity to the fullest. Okay, and at the end of the day, we have, and that was mentioned earlier, we have a situation that a lot of women, if they need urgently to find a resource and earn some money, they resort to vegetable sellers, going into markets, staying in the informal sector, which is characterized by low productivity and relatively low income, leading to unmet potential and really not using it to the fullest. The first area the Private Sector Development Initiative is focusing on is business law reform. And here we found, on the one hand, we have a lot of restrictions. The legal environment is absolutely not conducive to women entering private businesses. And we had just recently an assessment done in the Solomon Islands. And I don't know if you're aware of it. The Business Names Act stipulates that you have to have your husband's name on it. So you have to basically name your husband. So what do you do if you're not married? The Business Names Act basically prevents you from registering. I mean, it's all those little things which are absolutely critical, and you sometimes wonder in disbelief, how come? Now, these are all quite old legislations, and we are hoping that through collaboration with the respective governments that we will be able to help this along and redress the situation. Now, we have issues with regards to the burden of workload,
and we have issues with business structures and the type of business women can actually register. So we have the need in some of the countries that you have to have at least two people, and it has to be your husband or your brother to open a business. And we felt that maybe we need to look and help governments to find a different legal structure for a business to actually have help in setting up enterprises. And what we have done in the Solomon Islands are two things. We have helped institute a single proprietorship, so a single company registry. So you don't need to have your husband. You can just go and register. That basically helps you to go ahead and progress. You don't have to ask for permission. You don't have to have a signature. You basically are, if you like, empowered to set up a formal business. We also tried to incorporate the culture into the legal setup of a company and set up a community company legislation. So a group of women can register a company, and by doing so, it doesn't have to have, yet again, doesn't have to have the signature of a male member. It can be a group of women, a women's group, who registers, and basically by doing so, ensuring that the setup is sufficiently transparent to see where the resources are going and giving them the power over the resources they have earned in this company. Okay. What has happened in the Solomon Islands through these two aspects, in particular, we have now 825 female directors registered companies. And these are 25% up since we started in December 2010 up to last month. So this is really tangible. So we are seeing an increase just by changing the different legal options you have in registering a company. We have 867 registered female shareholders as well. And this is through the community company in particular. So up by 19%. And these type of legislative changes are critical for helping women to take the next step. So I have only four minutes left. I better hurry up. Access to finance. We all know that only 5% of the land is owned by women or together with their husbands, which basically makes it impossible to go to a commercial bank and tries to get a loan. So what have we done about that? We have started in 2006 to roll out a program on secure transaction reforms. Secure transaction reforms basically helps anybody, male as well as female, to use movable property as collateral to secure loans. This is quite something unique in a lot of areas. Australia only introduced this 2 years ago. 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago. This is relatively new in this part of the world. In the Pacific, this has already spread to 6 countries, and it does make a difference. I will not go into some of those details here, but what we have, unfortunately you can't see that, what we have with secure transaction reforms, it led to, it's on the bottom and it's hidden, we have about 500 new loans addressed and made available to women using secure transaction registries. This is commercial banks providing loans to women who have no access to land or house or something which normally is being used as collateral, which is absolutely critical. We have also worked with Microbank Nationwide to use mobile money transfers and MyCash, the introduction of MyCash, which led to over 4,000 new bank accounts being held by women. And this is exclusively the mobile technology. So it's really a step forward. It takes some time, but we are quite positive that this is leading into the right direction. And the last area I would like to share with you is, and Susan, you mentioned that, is the issue on SOEs. SOEs are dominated, the board of directors of SOEs are dominated by men, but in comparison to certain parts of the world, it's actually in the Pacific pretty good, I have to say. This is a big compliment. We have been training women as well as men to increase their capabilities and their know-how on how to manage SOEs, be an effective member of a board. We have increased, by doing so, we have increased the pool of potential members for SOEs, and we have seen an increase in SOE board members to 16%, which is quite remarkable. We should maybe have a look what is happening in Australia. I don't have the figures. I know in Europe it is appalling. In my home country it's a disaster. And so I'm quite embarrassed, and I think 16% is good, but there is plenty of room for improvement, and we shouldn't just stop there. Okay, and that leaves me to conclude that there is substantial progress made. It is not sufficient yet. There is plenty more which needs to be done, and we are going to monitor that very closely, and we are picking up on legal issues to progressives, we are picking up on the SOE reforms and progress women's involvement in it, and we will make an emphasis on access to finance and helping women to access financial services, not only loans. Thank you.
Little bit worried about the technology, so I'll try and keep my distance from it, but hopefully it will go well. I'd just like to say thank you to Tess for her wonderful introduction and to the Development Policy Centre for providing me the opportunity to present on some of the research into women's economic empowerment that we've conducted in our program, which is the Enterprise Challenge Fund. So I may just introduce the Enterprise Challenge Fund a little. It's a private sector development program providing grants to companies. The ECF was designed as a six-year program by the Australian government and funded by AusAid since 2007. So we are in that final year of the program. Grants of between 100,000 and 1.5 million were made available on a competitive basis to companies across nine countries in Asia and the Pacific. Companies needed to at least match the grants with their own funds. They had to demonstrate that the activities would be commercially sustainable within 3 years, and they needed to have benefits, so clear pro-poor benefits. And for that, we were looking at economic benefits like employment, interaction on the supply chain, or access to goods and services for ordinary people. So over three bidding rounds, there were 24 grants awarded, and 21 of those successfully completed 3 years. Just over two-thirds of these were in the Pacific. Now, I'm also going to have Andrea's disclaimer, but it was really important to note from the outset the ECF was not a women's economic empowerment program, and there was no explicit objective either. So the focus really was on economic improvement for both men and women. So let's have a look at the Pacific. 16 of the grants, two-thirds, were in the Pacific Islands. The key sectors were in agriculture, so supply chain development for export, and tourism improvement programs. This often involved creating new infrastructure or training programs with communities. I guess a note, and you probably will be seeing some of those numbers. So while only 4,590 of the beneficiaries were in the Pacific out of that 50,000, this really is due to the portfolio, that regional nature of the ECF, so the massive differences in the types of business and the populations in Asia. And for example, two projects in Asia had an outreach, a benefit outreach to over 40,000 people. So in this respect, a result of 4,500 in the Pacific is considered a really good result. But also of the income that was earned, quite a high percentage per person went to the Pacific, and that was really because companies were focusing on those higher income earning activities like employment and like being involved in the supply chain. So on supply chains, women were obviously a critical part on the supply chain, particularly in agriculture and tourism programs. However, it's clear that women and men play different roles in the results. So just a plug for our research, in 2012 we worked with two consultants, Kate Nethercott and Marianne Jacob Bassenthwaite, and we looked at how the private sector supported women's economic advancement, what did some of the examples from the ECF look like, and what are some of the lessons that can apply to other programs. I think it's really important that the reason we wanted to do this is because the private sector, a lot of people feel the private sector doesn't have these same issues or same interests as the development sector when it comes to benefiting women, but this isn't actually true. So I've just got a little slide about what ECF was doing in all of this, and there's a whole bunch of different activities we had in our contract around gender, but essentially the role of the ECF was to identify the right private sector business operators, those that had a social agenda and those that had a good proposal that were going to benefit people, and really to ensure that there was attention on those benefits when we conducted monitoring of the project. But much of the results is really because of the private sector's own initiative rather than any specific ECF contract requirement. So I'll skip through this and we'll have a look at some of the case studies from the monitoring program, because they're always a lot more interesting. So Volcanic Earth is the first example. It's a soap and beauty product manufacturer that had existing focus on women as customers. So they worked with a local company called Nuts and Oils and purchased a Tamanu nut oil. And that supply chain involved both men and women. So the men were involved in processing the oil in the factory, as the work was quite physically intensive, and involved in collecting the nuts, whereas groups of women, up to 15 women, received the nuts in large consignments near the villages, and they worked in a communal area, often close to a church or a community area, to peel, clean, dry, sort, pack the nuts, and they were then recollected back to the factory. So this work was flexible in participation, and it allowed women to work close to their homes. They were also able to elect how much of the workload that they could handle, and how they could fit this around other roles and responsibilities. So we actually found that in a number of case studies, as well in Asia, that this was quite an important factor to improving working with women who have to juggle a lot of responsibilities in the household. The second example is in Fiji. Nature's Way operates a factory that heat treats fruits and vegetables for the export market. Women were employed in a majority of the office positions in the factory because the floor work was actually heavy and there was manual packing and grading. Through the ECF grant, the company purchased automated packing and grading equipment to improve the factory processing. This reduced the weight of loads and allowed more women to be employed in the factory floor positions. So 5 years ago, there were no female employees, and now 5 out of the 10 employees at Nature's Way are women. Nature's Way actually made a point to note that they were continuously being encouraged to consider the impact of women through the ECF regular monitoring. Because our country managers asked for disaggregated data every quarter when they produced the figures, they were seeing what the difference really was. So I'll go on to the third example. Mainland Holdings has a factory in Leh, Papua New Guinea, and processes vanilla for exports. Now the company works with women in two particular ways. Firstly, the factory employs a majority of female workers for vanilla curing, working on call with greater hours during the peak seasons, and the operations are close to family homes. Secondly, in the fields, ECF-funded extension workers are working with families in improving the production of vanilla. So in particular, when the extension workers went to the farms and they focused their training of skills on pollinating of the vanilla plants to the women, because they noticed their attention to detail and found that they were better suited to this type of role. So what does this really mean beyond just increasing incomes and economic activities? I mean, does this actually equate to empowerment? And the ECF itself didn't really have a good system to measure beyond just the economic activities, which was our main focus. But as part of the monitoring program, we conducted a lot of focus groups with women. And the ECF collected a few specific examples where women felt that these activities had actually led to a better feeling of empowerment. So I've just picked a couple of small snippets from these, and there's more in the research paper. And an example is in Fiji, Future Forests employs women in a nursery to maintain teak seedlings, and they're earning around 150 Fiji dollars a week. So during the field visits, the women noted that they felt very proud and the extra income had increased their confidence. But they also found that the skills that they were learning from the nursery operations made them more productive in their home gardens. Also in Vanuatu, a cruise ship company, with the support of ECF, has invested in infrastructure that improves the tourism facilities. On the beach, when the passengers visit, typically women were involved in economic activities like selling crafts, food and drinks, other activities like hair braiding. The company had an equal opportunity employment, conditions in their own company. So when they went to train people in transit boat operations, so ferrying passengers between the shore and the ship, they made a point to train both two men and two women. So when we were talking to the women, they said that this was a really good opportunity for themselves, but also it allowed them to be a role model for other women so that they can show other females that girls can do it too. And just a final one, in Fiji with Nature's Way, they appointed a female board member in 2010, and the member actively advocates for extension work for female officers. So there's been a wider inclusion of female cooperative members, whereas before there was one cooperative member who was female, and now 14 out of 160. So these are some small changes, but it's an example of how economic opportunities and providing them to the right companies can benefit. So I just have a last slide with a couple of lessons for private sector development. The full research has a lot more, but I've just picked out a couple from here. The first one is really considering that there's a different context across Asia and the Pacific, and it's very hard in a regional program that crosses that to have done enough research beforehand to make a big impact here. For example, what roles do women and men have on the supply chain in the Pacific? So the research didn't have a chance to look into this in more detail, and it would certainly benefit from more work. I'll just run through the last three. So it's important also to highlight the business case for involving women in economic activities. It really is a business decision, and it's where markets exist, so working with the right companies and ensuring that the private sector understands that there's a market where women are excluded, so that means 50% of customers and suppliers are. Two small points for donors. Funds can actually be targeted at specific sectors where women are involved and where resources are lacking. And that would be a good use of funds. And finally, the research found that gender inclusion or mainstreaming wasn't really enough to have a real impact on women's economic empowerment. There really needs to be a consideration of a specific focus that can be agreed from the outset and then inbuilt into the measurement system. So that would be a good use of a future challenge fund.
Okay, I'd like to thank my team for having done a great job on timekeeping. I think we can scrimp a few minutes for questions. So there are some rules about questions. One is, please keep your question very short. If you have two questions, please pick your favorite question now. And if you want to make a comment, I'm sure whoever you want to discuss with will be available afterwards. So please keep comments for outside the room and we'll just stick to questions. So I'll do a quick harvest of three or so questions and then we'll put it to the panel for them to respond. Yes.
I wanted to ask Susan Ferguson, what baseline data are you collecting to show the changes over the 10 years?
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Margaret?
Thank you. I have a question for both Andrea and Amanda. Both of you said that the women's economic income was not a specific objective of your programs. So how did it get translated into the way the programs rolled out?
Okay, thank you. We can probably squeeze in one more if anybody's got one. Yes.
Just to make a point to Andrew, I think Papua New Guinea has three women in Parliament. So he actually mentioned there was only one.
Okay, thank you. Another question, yes?
I think most of the statistics that are behind the work to be done in gender are negative in terms of the region and how they've been performed. I'd like to ask, how much of the program is looking at delivery at regional level and the pluses that can go with the push of a regional approach to reverse some of those trends, and how much of the program will be done at local level, national level? And then my last point is, I think, Susan, you've been talking about we would like to work. I'm asking who is the we, because I think we need to take careful note of the issues of ownership. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, we might revert to the panel. So, Susan, would you like to address the two questions in relation to the programme, and then Andrea and Amanda can address the others that they've been asked?
Okay. So the we is very inclusive. So sometimes in my presentation I meant we as in AusAid. Other times I meant we as in, you know, ourselves and partners, whether they're government, community, or development partners like the ADB, for example. So it really varies across the different countries and the different contexts. So in terms of it, but I mean the local ownership side of things is absolutely essential in this. One of the slides I didn't get to was around the governance arrangements. So there's a regional advisory board that includes 9 eminent people from across the region. 2 of those are men and the others are women. And in the different countries, various countries in the design process are coming up with their own governance arrangements to try and get that regular input from stakeholders, from community upwards. So it really varies, you know, given it's such a complex program, it has to vary across the different areas to make sure that it fits the context. What was the other thing? We're aiming at spending about 30% of that $320 million at regional level and 70% within country programs. So in terms of the baseline, that's again very difficult. And in fact, some of the money will be allocated to collecting a baseline in certain areas, because one of the key things that we want to contribute to is that understanding about what causes change. So we have to have good measurements at the beginning that we can track changes. I mean, again, in the violence against women space, there's very good prevalence data, and there will be that, I think, in, is it 11 countries? There will be. So we'll be able to track changes in terms of rates of prevalence over time. But in some of the other areas, there's not data. And that's one of the, that's why it's a key result area, is to get more information, more data, including baselines.
That's great. Thanks. Andrea, would you like
yes,
to?
Yes, there was one question, what we did and how we came to integrate economic empowerment of women in the private sector development initiative. We started off with the key areas of SOE reform, on access to finance and business law reform. And as we were working with respective governments on their request on a range of initiatives, we started collecting data very rigorously. And gender disaggregated data. That was a way of doing things, which then made us realize that we actually had an impact, and that it showed that it has quite a bearing on women, what the reforms which we were rolling out, which then made us realize there is really an aspect which we haven't highlighted and which we basically unintentionally addressed. Subsequently, we in the Private Sector Development Initiative number 3, which just started, we have integrated one key result area on economic empowerment of women, where we will have pilot initiatives doing consciously exactly that, with partner governments to single out a range of areas where we are going to go deeper into, for example, business law reform, the ownership structures of markets, and the potential on how to redress it through different different management arrangements and so on, and use that as examples to see if this would be a way forward in other countries as well. So we came from not singling it out, realizing we make a difference, and then integrating it in the current phase, and then subsequently scaling it up and opening it up for replication if this is adequate in other countries.
Okay, that's great. Amanda, have you got a couple of comments for us to finish with?
Sure. I guess in terms of ECF not having an explicit objective around women's economic empowerment, the program had a couple of areas where we could actually have an impact. So they had some things in there that we could play around with. Firstly, in the selection process, we targeted women's groups as well as part of the marketing of the fund. So when we went to every different country, we also looked at where there, you know, women's groups, where there, you know, women's chambers that could also be part of our selection process, that could also be targeted part of the marketing. We also had a selection panel, independent assessment panels, and we also looked at actively bringing more women onto those assessment panels. The applications and the notes to get the concept notes and the applications that we used had points in there about what will this do for women, this project. So there was some aspect in the selection process that said, will this have an impact on women and what will it be? And finally, in monitoring, and Andrea mentioned this as well, that in fact collecting gender disaggregated data was a really big way to show to the companies that we were serious about looking at how does this impact on men and women. And I was surprised because I thought it would be something, I wouldn't see that it would be something so simple that would have such a big impact. But when our country managers would go and collect this data and they could see the big difference, the companies then started asking why. And then we also had focus groups that we did. And we had two monitoring advisors who were female. So they would often take women and ask them, okay, this program's happened, you know, what's been the result for you and what has this really meant? So we had some areas, in fact, that we could take a little bit more of be able to show us what we were actually doing and achieving. And so it was unexpected, but there was a bigger impact than we thought we would have.
Okay, that's great. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to thank the panel for a great